We'll talk about firewall, the internet, and secure enterprise networking today. And I am Fred Cohen.
I'll start by showing you the slide guide. And this is the most complex set of overhead view graphs ever created by humanity. So you need a guide to the slide in order to understand what it says. So I'm going to talk about background introduction, firewalls as an instrument of policy, give you the basics of firewalls, and then it's going to be about the 8 hours of total time we'll spend on this. We'll get to package folders, application gateways, implementation strategies, tools, commercial products, case studies, and some summary and conclusion information. So this is the way the slides look here. The title of the slide is up around the top. Then brown things up in the upper right-hand corner are these repeated themes. I have these repeated themes that I'm going to carry through the course. You may recall from one of our earlier courses, we had a repeated theme. What was the repeated theme? It was like, you can't, you know, the packets are all just like stuff, a bunch of bits that come from somebody you don't trust, something like that. That kind of theme is going to go up there. And the content of the slide comes down here. And you get the idea. And then nice-looking but meaningless slide thing for the color and interest goes up along the left side. So it sort of keeps you from getting too color bored. Things in red are bad things. Things in blue are good things. And things in brown are words of wisdom. Then we use clip art over here generally for your viewing pleasure. And we make diagrams that are supposed to help you understand the content.
Line.
I'm for the government, and I'm here to help you. No, really. Basically, I deal in the field of information protection, which some people, we break it down into information assurance and information security because people tend to use the word that way. Information assurance is getting the right information to the right place at the right time. And information security is like keeping the wrong information from getting to the wrong place at the wrong time. So remembering that that's our goal. I have an approach that I take, and I'm going to be looking in this course at these different viewpoints on protection, management policy, standards, procedures, and so forth. And we'll use that as a guide to make sure we don't miss anything and that we understand the issues. I want to start by talking a little bit about the information age and the information age risks and statistics, basic protection issues, organizational perspective. Talk about the change from non-network computers towards network computers. Talk about firewalls and technical protection. I'm going to move over to the other side so you guys over here can't see anything for a while. After all, you guys have already seen it once, and these guys are completely new. Basically, the information age has some characteristics that differentiate it from previous ages. Those of you that aren't familiar, you know, we had this agricultural, the agrarian age, human beings start out as hunters and gatherers, maybe drop and sort of survive by hunting for food and gathering. In fact, I guess we started out by eating the marrow out of bones that other animals had already killed. And one of the humanity survived because we figured out as a race to use sharp stones to break the bones and eat the marrow, otherwise we would have starved to death. And then eventually learned how to hunt and learned how to gather and became farmers. And then moved from farming through the use of technology into these various Bronze Age and Iron Age and, you know, so from the Stone Age forward. And eventually moved into the Industrial Age. And the Industrial Age was characterized by mass production. And this is where we could, through efficiency, economy of scale, it's called, through an economy of scale, we could produce enormous volumes of the same thing, one after another, and the price would become very small, and we were able to do so much in that Industrial Age that we built essentially all of the houses and all of the civilization that we now know, which is, you know, far more in terms of the total number of things that we have than humanity has ever known. In fact, the average person living in America today has a far better life than any human being, even the greatest king living, say, 100 years ago. And so that's a result largely of the Industrial Age and this mass production and this economy of scale. Well, recently, humanity has discovered increasingly the value of information. In fact, information, of course, was always a great value for cryptography, for example. The field has lasted more than 5,000 years, I believe. So information has always been important, but as we move into the the information age, this is the era where information dominates what we do and how we do it. And it's not that the agricultural thing is gone. We still make food. We still need to eat. And the industrial age is still with us. We still mass produce lots of things, including the tools of the information age. But the thing that differentiates the information age from the previous ages is that it's extremely fast-paced. That is, things happen in very short time frames compared to in other ages of humanity. We have very little throw weight. So you know, if you look at the military side of the world, mass production meant mass production of weapons of mass destruction. Lots and lots of little bombs and some really big bombs. Right? And the whole notion of that kind of warfare was that we can destroy every living being in the enemy's camp until there's nothing left. You know, a war of attrition, sort of the words that you get. And after you've killed everybody, then you won. Now, it turns out that that's almost never happened. There's no war in which anybody's actually killed everybody on the other side. But nevertheless, that was the notion of it. Well, in the information age, if you look at the military side, you see these very small, relatively lightweight weapons that were able to pinpoint target. So it's a difference. We're throwing less bulk, but we're throwing it more accurate. We're running at a much faster pace. It's a highly adaptive environment. In the industrial age, we did mass production, which means that we spent a lot of money building a machine that could put out, you know, a Model T Ford. Big, huge machine, lots of people trained in their specific tasks, and then we can put out Model T Fords at an incredible rate. But if you wanted, like, a Model T with a green door, you know, what was the saying? Model T comes in any color you want as long as it's black. Well, so the information age is different because it's highly adaptive. Another feature is that it's very communication intensive. Okay, the whole notion is that we get everything done by communicating rather than by sitting on ourselves and working. In fact, historically where value has lied is now changing. Value now lies more in communicating information than it lies in having information. Very important difference, especially in information protection. The information age is highly dependent on technology, much more so than previous ages. And there's a lot of just-in-time issues, and hopefully we'll get to them at some point in our various courses. And some examples that we're going to be talking about is the small international businesses. Small international businesses did not exist 10 years ago. It was essentially impossible to have a small business that was international because the costs associated with doing that were horrendous. But with the invention of the fax machine, all of a sudden contract negotiations for international contracts came down to hours instead of weeks and months, and there was no travel required. So the difference of the information age in terms of the communication facilitating this meant that there were small international businesses where this essentially did not exist before this. Another example is telecommuting, which is a trade-off between communication and transportation. Okay, if you think about the industrial age, we moved increasingly from a society where people were spread all over the place farming, wherever farmable land was around, to big cities, where we centralized things around transportation hubs, rivers, and the location of railroads were critical. As we moved towards the information age, we have telecommuting. That's no longer true. Okay, you can be just as effective in Livermore as in downtown San Francisco, maybe more effective at all sorts of things. And in fact, you can be just as effective out in the middle of Kansas somewhere, in a lot of ways, as you can be in downtown New York. Okay, so we see that, for example, with trading, right? It used to be the New York Stock Exchange and the Chicago Mercantile Exchange were it. Now you get trading companies that are located, you know, in Joe's garage. Yeah. So this whole thing has changed because communication has taken over from transportation because of the low throw weight, high speed, and communication intensivity. Another example is websites and internet marketing. A very dramatic change in marketing has happened over the last couple of years, and it's still happening, to where the web is now the marketing venue of choice. And one of the reasons is it's incredibly inexpensive to market on the web compared to almost any other kind of marketing.
to send you a piece of mail, to send a mail, a large-scale mailing to people costs an average of about $1 per item. Okay, and so if you're selling a $10 item, oh, and there's another thing, and that is that the percentage of sales out of a typical mailing by a mail order is less than 0.5%. So if I send out 1,000 mailers, I'll probably get 5. If I've done a reasonably good job, or quite a good job, I'll get 5 sales out of that. So if it's $1 each, that means 1,000 sales, I've gotten in 1,000 mailings, I've gotten in 5 sales, that means the average price has to be $200 to hit break even in a mail order business of that sort. Now there are exceptions, but now let's look at the same thing on the web. On the web, what's the cost of sending you an email? Not zero, just close to zero. Certainly for 0.1%, I can send out a lot of emails. Right, there's an overhead, there's a bandwidth and so forth, but it's very inexpensive to send out gobs and gobs of email. A website, okay, to put a billboard up, maybe $100,000. You know what a website costs? Let's see, mine, I have a very expensive one. It's almost $125 a month, and it has, you know, 50 megabytes of space and handles, you know, gobs and gobs of traffic and has all sorts of features in it. A typical website, you can get a small one for $25 a month. Okay, so it's several orders of magnitude change in the cost associated with marketing. Another thing that's happened is information warfare. Hey, Dick, how's it? Information warfare is another evolution, revolution? Interesting question. You know, it used to be that warfare consisted largely, as I mentioned earlier, of blowing things up. Well, these days, that's almost untrue. In fact, there are large segments of what we think of as warfare that now don't involve killing anybody. It turns out this has always been true. Okay, let me give you a really good example that you should all be aware of, and that's World War II. Okay? World War II, the reason Hitler came to power was because of his skill in what we would now call information warfare. You know, he was, I think he had 1 or 2% of the population of Germany 2 years before he became chancellor. He was able to convince the population of Germany to change this. And one of the techniques he used, for example, was he flew all around the country. He was the first politician to ever fly as part of his campaign for office. He flew all over the country, and he sold himself very well. He also used all sorts of nasty, nasty tactics, but basically he used a tremendous amount of propaganda of a variety of sorts, and that's how he succeeded largely through this information warfare. He also managed to convince people that Jews and gypsies were horrible creatures and to kill millions of them, and I think ultimately World War II killed something on the order of 50 million people. Largely out of his control of information. And I don't want you to think that it was missing from the other side, because on the Allied side, information was critical to the war effort. In fact, the breaking of the Enigma cipher, one of the German ciphers for communicating information, was key to winning the Battle of Britain. In fact, there are many people that claim that if it wasn't for that aspect of information warfare, the Allies would not have won the war. Now, you know, there are lots of people that claim all sorts of things, but I thought you'd like to know that one. These days, information warfare is a very serious, a large part of the things that we deal with. There are information age risks. Because we have gone to this highly information-intensive way of doing business, we have an increase in our dependency on information and information systems. And when you talk about risk, we talk about, there are a couple of ways of talking about it that we'll use. One of them is that the dependency, what we depend on, plus its vulnerability, plus the threats that are able to exploit that vulnerability, are the things that produce risk. Another way to write this equation is threats plus vulnerability plus consequences equal risks. Okay, so if you look at the risks of the information age, there are a lot of different dependencies that lead to risk. There's personal dependency. So, for example, my grandmother, who is still alive at 105, she's coming up on 105, I guess, has a pacemaker. Okay, now, I think I told you the story about her pacemaker battery, but I'll tell you again anyway, because it's fun. when she was in her upper 80s, early 90s, a young lady at the time, she called my uncle, who recently deceased, who was a doctor, and said she was feeling kind of sluggish. And he said, well, let's go check it out. So he went over and checked it out. Her heartbeat was at 4 per minute. And she's on a pacemaker. Well, you know, with a pacemaker, your heartbeat, that means the pacemaker's going 4 beats a minute. So they took her right into the hospital and did an operation. What they found out was that the battery had run down on her pacemaker. Okay? She was down to 4 beats a minute because the battery was just about out of juice. Okay, now, when they initially put these pacemakers in, they said 15, 20 years, hey, no problem. You know, who's going to live 20 years? You know, you're already, you know, 70 years old. You're not going to live another 20 years. Turns out people are living longer, and they never figured that out. So there are all these people out in the world at that time that had pacemakers that they never had a track of to know when to replace the batteries. So this is an information age risk. This is an information system that sits there and remembers when to tell your heart to beat. All right, so that's a pretty personal dependency. Now, who here uses something personal in their lives that has to do with an information system? Anybody think of anything? Eli has one.
Palm Pilot.
Okay. You're dependent on it. If it fails, you're not going to remember, like, where to go after this meeting, right?
I'm not going to know
who I am. Yep. That's pretty important. Now, I recently got the piece of the paper, and if this thing catches fire, it's all over. I won't know where my wife is staying. Right? I'll never be able to call her. I won't remember what my kids' names are. It's terrible. How about like money? Anybody here use information systems to get money and deal with money?
Sure,
everybody. An ATM card. Credit cards.
Your bank.
Your bank is probably, you know, that's, well, we'll get to that. But your how about gasoline? You need gas in your car. How do you get it? You pay with cash? Or you use that little plastic card, you slide the card in. Information systems all down the line. If that information system fails, you can't get gas for your car, you can't get food for your plate, you can't eat, you can't pay your mortgage, you can't get paid, of course, because we only do electronic deposits here, right? Right, absolutely, direct deposit only. So if you personally, if all these information systems started to really fail for, you know, in a serious way, you would personally be harmed, okay? But nothing's more personal than the medical devices. And there are cases of people being killed by medical devices that had failures in the information system. The Therac 7, I believe, radiation therapy machine, yes, that killed a number, I think 7 people died because of a programming error. Oops. Oh, well. We fixed it, though. We found the bug, and then we fixed it.
So there's a patch for that.
There's a patch. You have to remember to install it. Oh, and we forgot it in version 8. Sorry, but that's all right. The patch is still there. We'll upgrade it for you. A couple more people died. No problem. We'll fix it. Right, all right, so how about corporate dependency? You're all in a corporation of some sort here, and your corporation depends on information systems, and they fail. For example, anybody here ever managed to do their time card?
Nobody yet, okay.
So your time card system here is totally screwed up because it doesn't work right, but it's all information system dependent. It's designed for people that aren't me. It's designed for somebody else. And it works for the vast majority of people, but if you're one of those, you know, poor innocent victims that's stuck in the it doesn't work for me situation, then doing your time cards can become a nightmare. And every corporation has dependency, and the larger the corporation, the more dependent. Let me give you a really good example. Just-in-time. You guys hear of just-in-time? Just-in-time delivery? It's a tremendous boom. It means that instead of keeping all sorts of reserve inventory and paying money for the inventory and then holding it in some place, which costs you, you mean, instead of having cash, you have inventory sitting there. So instead of making interest on your money, you have inventory that's losing value with time. You have a warehouse that you have to pay to have the warehouse, so you're paying for a building, and then you have people that move stuff into the warehouse and then out of the warehouse, and then into the warehouse and out of it. So there's employees, there's all sorts of overhead, you got to keep track of it, you need computer systems, everything. Horrendous stuff. What they do is they eliminate it. They say, when we need it, we know you can deliver those bumpers in 3 days and 4 hours. So as every bumper comes off our assembly line, we're going to send you a message saying, we need another bumper of this sort to be here in 3 days and 4 hours. And if everything works right, then you make the bumper, It gets on a truck. The truck arrives at our door. It goes right into the plant and goes right onto the car. It's all just in time. Okay? That's very heavily dependent on information systems. An information system screws up, you're screwed. Okay, I don't know how else to say it. You don't have any bumpers for your cars. The whole car line stops. All that other just-in-time stuff, you now have trucks coming to the door for the next several days, piling stuff up that you can't use. And you don't have anywhere to put it or any way to keep track of it. Okay, this has happened. Okay, an example, there was a strike of a manufacturer, a small company. I believe it was in Ohio. It's only maybe 10 or 15 employees. They went on strike. You know what they were making? Foam bumpers. And I believe it was GM. Was it GM or was it Ford? I think it was GM. GM stopped producing cars. Oops. How much do you figure they were willing to pay those guys to come back to work? Basically, whatever it took, sole supplier. Okay, now let's think about year 2000. Okay, when year 2000, everybody's so interdependent, if any of those systems anywhere along that supply chain fail, there's the potential that that whole manufacturing operation run will fail. And it will then cause everybody downstream to fail because of this just-in-time way that we're doing it. So this corporate dependency is becoming extreme, and to get little bits of efficiency, we're taking all the redundancy out of these systems, which means that it depends critically on those information systems working correctly and working correctly all the time, every second. And if they fail, we could be in a lot of hurt. Government dependency. Now, government's very interesting. I've been trying to figure out what it is that governments do. Actually, there's the whole question, what the heck do governments do? What do they do that isn't strictly information? Besides wars. Right? They blow things up. That's not strictly information. It depends on information, but they do those things. And then they move a lot of people and stuff like that. But almost everything in government does is information. And it's heavily dependent on information systems.
Public works.
Public works. Oh, see, you found that yet another thing they do. They do public works. Thank you. I knew there was something else they did. So if you look at the budget for government and you subtract public works and you subtract war, that's all an information system. Medicare, the government doesn't do any of the medical care. It's just acting as an information system moving money around. Prisons, that's like a public works prison. And then anymore, that's privatized, right? Governments, they're just handling the information aspects of it. Essentially, almost everything that governments do, or in fact, besides governments, there's a wonderful book written by Jim Switzer, who used to be an
executive at, I guess it was Xerox, and before he went to another large company. And he was in information protection all of his career.
And one of the things he noted in his book is, if you take the average company and you subtract out the physical assets that they have, everything else is an information asset. The vast majority of the value of almost every organization in the world is an information value. Look at its people. I mean, how many people these days work lifting heavy things? None. Almost none. They get machines because machines are better at lifting heavy things. People are information workers. And the better we do, the better our industrial age succeeds, the more we become information workers and the more critically dependent we are on information systems. Human information systems, our ability to communicate, automated information systems, their ability to help us get our jobs done. Indeed, there is global dependency because when something fails in one country because of our interdependence based on supply, let me give you a great example, global dependency. There was a fire in a glue factory in, I believe, Singapore, a couple years back. Anybody remember this fire? All right, you don't probably remember the fire. Well, the fire took out the glue factory. The glue factory was producing the glue used to glue the caps on integrated circuits for memory. Uh-oh, right, there was a global shortage of memory chips for computer systems. The price of computers and memory skyrocketed. There was a fairly large-scale impact on the price of computers and a fairly large-scale economic impact worldwide. From a fire at a glue factory across the world, we were unable to build computers.
Okay, it's that simple. That's how interdependent we are.
We're going to discuss vulnerabilities later, and threats we'll discuss a little bit, but they are mostly dependent on the organization you're trying to protect.
Here's some statistics that might be of interest. One of them is that currently, if you stick a machine out on the internet, this is actually an older figure, you get about one crow per internet site per day, I guess the best statistic right now is about two or three crows per week. Okay, so if you just stick a random machine on the internet, you give it a random IP address, you don't advertise it, you don't say anything about it, you don't do anything about it, it's just sitting there, a couple of times a week somebody will probe that machine looking for some vulnerability. Okay, and if they find it, they will likely try to exploit it. That's average. Yes, sir?
For my machine anyway, that's up more around between 5 and 10 per week.
You're on the order of one per day on your machine. You must know about your machine.
Not really.
Just random? Okay, one per day?
It's an at-home box that acts as a black hole that anybody can post it.
Yeah, just sitting on a cable on them.
And you can't even get ICMP packets back out.
Yeah, so just a packet shows up at it on the average once a day, give or take.
Yeah.
That doesn't belong there.
Whatever.
Yeah, one of those published attacks. Okay, so maybe my site is less popular. Nobody's done any good statistics on this, but the statistics show something on the order of one a day to one a week, something in that range. Now, let me give you another example. This is a bank that I know of that a couple of years ago was tracking between 20 and 50 attempts per day to break into the bank via their internet site. There's a Lloyd's of London underwriter some years ago that indicated that, according to their statistics, 4% of the gross national product, or I guess now it's called gross domestic product, of most industrialized nations is lost every year. 4% lost every year due to information-related crimes. Okay? That's pretty serious. Let's see. It's very common to have losses in the order of $10 to $50 million. Very common, $10 to $50 million losses. Larger losses happen occasionally. In fact, I think last week there was some guy at some bank siphoned off funds using the computer systems to do it. It was a couple $100 million made in the media. Information crime and information-related crimes are increasing with usage. I mean, these days, if you don't have somebody attempt some crime or another against you, you must, like, not have an email anywhere. Okay, there's all sorts. There's hate crimes, there's, you know, email frauds, there's taking advantage of youth, right, so-called kiddie porn is enormous. There are people arrested now probably several times a week. You can read about somebody being arrested for soliciting a youngster over the internet and getting them to meet them physically somewhere so they could have sex with them. Now, these are the people arrested, okay? And that's got to be a very small percentage of the people that are actually getting caught up in this sort of activity. There's, in fact, some say that there's a doubling of attacks every 6 months. Okay, right now it's pretty ferocious out there and getting worse. American Society for Industrial Security did a survey, 92 through 97, that said that some industries are at greater risk. For example, microelectronics is one of the highest risk types of organizations. So if you do any research in microelectronics, as an example, then that would be a very important industrial risk. Attacks are on the increase. In 92, 40% insider, 40% outsider, 20% joint between an insider and an outsider. By 97, the statistics said 80% of all losses to computer crime involve an insider, somebody with legitimate access who takes advantage of the authority they've been given. Most companies are reporting being hit more than once a year. That is a crime that they've detected. That doesn't include all the ones they don't detect. Another statistic that's fairly interesting is that the number of detections is, if you do good detection, you get two orders of magnitude in increase in the number of attacks you detect. Okay, so that's a factor of 100. Okay, FBI Computer Security Institute study. In 98, 95% of companies had losses from information-related crimes, and many had break-ins through their internet firewalls. A very large portion of them.
The organizational perspective that I take, and we'll be coming back to this later, is that we have management policy, standards, procedures, technical safeguards, audit documentation, incident response, testing, physical protection, personnel issues, legal considerations, awareness, training, and education, and organization for information protection. And the suitability of a firewall can really only be properly understood in the context of this overall protection program that involves all of these elements. So it doesn't make sense to say, oh, I have a firewall and I'm safe, because it's just a technology in the mix of other technologies that you have. Now, typically a firewall is one of these technical safeguards. Okay, so if you look at the whole protection, information protection picture, technical safeguards are something like 10% of the activity surrounding it, and a firewall is one of those things that sits in that 10% of activities that have to do with that technical safeguard.
Hello?
Hey, Tom, can I call you later? Bye.
That was easy. See, now, my wife is off getting her master's degree, so she's in Indiana. I have four kids at home, so I can't turn off the cell phone under any condition. When one of the kids calls and says, there's a fire, Dad, I'm out of here.
I'll dial 911 on my way home. There are three basic protection issues. Actually, we're going to go up to four protection issues that organizations typically deal with. One of them is the integrity issue. In other words, availability of services, and there's liability issues and damage to reputation and so forth. And then there's confidentiality. I just want to point out that the importance of these things is typically in this order: integrity, availability, then confidentiality. Okay. Whereas in the history of information protection, security has always been associated with secrecy. And if you listen in the media, you'll hear reports that say, there was a computer break-in, blah, 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 but no classified information was leaked. That's a typical thing that you'll hear. Another one is, there was a computer break-in to a large bank, and $400,000 was stolen, but no private information was given out. Oh, well, that makes me feel safe. Okay, they don't know my phone number, which they get from the phone book that the bank had as private information, but they did take all my money. Okay, so, and if you look at the response, the knee-jerk response to most organizations, when they have a protection failure, they're rushing to put more secrecy protection in place. But that's not what's most important. And in fact, most companies have come to realize that they're misappropriating or misallocating their funds when they go this way. So they're starting to concentrate increasingly on integrity and availability over confidentiality. And I'm going to give you an example. Suppose you're in the military and you're driving a tank. And you have an information system in that tank, and it helps to tell you where to go, what to shoot at, and what not to shoot at, like your friends. Okay, you're driving that tank. What would be the worst thing that would happen? If somebody knew where your tank was, that'd be pretty bad. Right? If you lost the confidentiality, if they could get access to your computer system and read where you were going to shoot at next, that would make a difference, right? That'd be pretty bad. Right? Would that be worse or better than your computer system stopped working and you don't know where to go or what to shoot at?
Better.
They got to be better.
No. Them having a cap would be better than complete denial of services.
Yeah, complete denial of services would be worse for you than them being able to read your stuff, because frankly, when you aim and shoot, the amount of time they have to react isn't enough, so that getting into your computer system would actually help them get out of the way of that bullet, but that's another issue. How about this one? How about if your information was corrupted so that you shot at your guys and your guys shot at you, and the enemy was telling you where to shoot? That's even worse than any of them, okay? Think in these terms, okay? Integrity, if the information is wrong, what good would it do to keep it secret? Okay? Hey, I have this big bad secret here. It's the design of my integrated circuit, only it's wrong. Right? But I can nobody else can read it. They can just make it so it's not right anymore. So my chip won't work, but they won't be able to get my design. Alright? Is that better than they can get my design, darn it, but the chip will work? Almost always it's better that the integrity of the information is protected. Now there are exceptions. Okay? Like, you know, the codes to the things that are going to blow something up should probably be kept secret. In that case, corrupting the codes means we can't blow anything up. I can take it. Okay, it's a deal.
That's only my personal viewpoint. That may not be the viewpoint of other organizations. Depends on what your priorities are.
Okay. Now, when you move from not internet to internet, there's a big cliff you're walking off. I'm going to just tell you that so you understand the difference. And when you don't have an internet, you have limited access. Okay?
The only people that can access it are the people that have physical access or that have the right phone numbers. Or, I mean,
it's relatively limited. In the internet, access is wide open. Anyone from anywhere has the potential to access a system. Without the internet, when somebody makes a connection, you can trace it because you know what wire you put where. You know where it is. You put it there.
With the internet,
it's essentially impossible to really trace down where somebody connects to.
Now, it's not completely impossible. If you have enough juice and enough law enforcement and enough money and all this stuff, and if the connection doesn't go through one of those places that just folds their arms and says, I'm not going to tell you about it, then
you can trace it sometimes. But largely untraceable on the internet. Without an internet, if you have a company with 10,000 people, you have 10,000 potential people that might attack you. That's a pretty big company. If you have the internet, you have 25, 50, 100 million people that are out there that are potential threats. Any of those people has the ability to exploit. Without our internet, you tend to know each other. Okay? At least everybody in your company probably knows somebody else in the company, right? I mean, there's nobody that works as a full-time employee of the company that's never met anybody else in the company. You know, we hope. If that's true, probably it means somebody's already gotten into your information system. It's not really an employee.
So
whereas in the internet, then you don't know anybody. Who
are you? I'm Quizzo@Marky.com. Who was that man? Oh, that was Quizzo. Was it a man? Oh, who was that woman? It was Quizzo. How old is Quizzo? 13? 28? 95? We don't have any idea at all. Now look, this is wonderful. Okay, when you talk about absolutely decimating the notion of discrimination, it's fantastic. This technology means you can't tell if I'm white or black or male or female or green or purple. And that's wonderful for eliminating discrimination, but it has this other effect, and that is you don't know who you're dealing with. You never know who you're dealing with at the other end. Without an internet, it's really hard to get by with lie after lie after lie, because eventually the people around you will say, you know, he's a liar. And they'll all know, look, this guy always lies. I used to have a boss some years back. This guy was a huge liar, and everybody knew it. Now, I always believed everybody was honest, you know, stupid me. And look at the field I work in, right? How could I possibly believe? But nevertheless, you know, I try to believe people are honest. This guy would lie about anything. He would say, this is purple, if he thought it was some advantage, even though it's not, it's gray. But he'd say, look, no, this is purple because we're going to get $500,000 in grant money because it's purple, so it's purple. Right? That's just how it's hard to lie in person, but it's very easy to lie on the internet. Extremely easy, right? Send an email, in fact, it's a big problem. Send an email and says, you can make $50,000 at home this week by sending me like $12.85. And I won't even charge your credit card number for 6 months until you're rich and living in the Bahamas. Just give me your credit card number now, and I won't use it. Sure. Okay.
Very easy. And a lot of people buy it. Internet, let's see, and without an internet, you have this thing called internal controls, where you're trying to control what's going on, that you have checks and balances to make sure that things are working right. In the internet, there are no controls. You want to set up an internet service provider.
You got a PC at home? Okay, you got a credit card? A couple $1,000 balance? No, well, borrow one from somebody. You can be an internet service provider. Like that. You can start selling service to anybody in the world. No controls. Nothing at all. You could become one of the biggest internet service. In fact, in San Jose, one of the biggest internet service providers in the world right now was started out as a couple guys in their garage. It was five, six years ago. Multi-billion-dollar company. Sold three times since then. They're living a good life. Okay. With no internet, there is typically an internal police force in a company. An internal security force. On the internet, there's no security. There's no police force for the internet. If somebody breaks into your computer, who are you going to call? Then call the FBI. Ha! You call the FBI, unless you have some really good political connection, or the loss is more than a couple $100,000, and they think it's worth their time to pursue it, or the guy in the FBI happens to be your brother-in-law, and he wants to be your friend, they will laugh to themselves. They won't laugh to you. They'll say, thank you very much. We'll look right in. Hang up the phone, but nothing will happen. Now, you call the local police. When I was living in Monroe Falls, Ohio, a couple years ago, I was living in Monroe Falls, Ohio. You don't know where Monroe Falls is. It's outside of Akron. You don't know where Akron is. Near Cleveland. You know where Cleveland is, right? So it's somewhere in the Midwest. It's actually the Mideast that we call the Midwest. All right, so I was living in Monroe Falls. Somebody tried to break into my computer system, a really ferocious attack. Okay? I tried to call whoever I could call, and what I found out is you have to report it to the local police force first. So I called the Monroe Falls police. And the Monroe Falls policeman stopped by my house a day or two later, said, hi, I'm so-and-so from the Monroe Falls Police Force. Nice to meet you. Oh, nice to meet you, too. So you realize we don't know anything about computers. In fact, you realize we don't even have any computers. We don't, actually, I've never seen a computer except in a store. Could you, like, show me the computer and I'll take a report for you? You understand, we're not going to do anything about it, but since you need a report, we will file a report. Okay? And on the report, it said, you know, report filed because, you know, we needed a report filed. No action intended. We're not doing anything. We don't know what, nothing about computers. You say some guy from Rome was involved? What? You know, Monroe Falls local police. Are we going to call Rome? No. We are only allowed to make local phone calls. We can't call Rome. You know, I make, you know, $18,000 a year. This is my second part-time job. I'm not calling Rome off my home phone to try and track down some guy on the internet that's trying to break in your computer. I don't care what he stole. With no internet, you have a support staff, right? You have the people that work in that function in your business that run information technology that can trace things down and help you out. On the internet, you're on your own. All you can do is try and convince somebody in the Netherlands via email to try and track down some guy that you think attacked your system. And I've talked to people in the Netherlands, and they're extremely friendly, but they are of no help. They just flat will not help you in any way, shape, or form. They'll say, I think it's terrible that that happened to you, but I'm not going to help. The one thing I found that worked was I said, okay, we're not going to let anybody from your organization use our website. At which point he said, okay, rather than cut off access to our people, I will trace it down for you as a personal favor. Because access to information is more important to them than whether you get attacked. Firewalls are, you can talk about them in many different ways, but I like to think of them as an instrument of policy. Okay? What firewalls do is, you have something you want to accomplish. You have an organizational objective that is in the form of some policy that says, for example, nobody that's not allowed to access the employee database is going to be given access to the employee database. That would like be a policy. Actually, that'd be sort of detailed. But a policy might be only authorized users can perform authorized functions on authorized systems. And then this would be a specific example of that. A firewall is an instrument of that policy. That is, if there's no basic underlying policy, political organizational reason to provide protection, there's no reason to have that firewall there. It's not there for fun. It costs money. It's there to fulfill the policy for fun. Okay? It's also a technical safeguard. It has limitations, but we'll go to this. So policy dictates the purpose of the firewall. It should dictate what is allowed to pass and what is not allowed to pass the firewall. It should dictate who controls the firewall. Who's in charge? Who decides whether this is going to be allowed or not? A lot of organizations have a big problem with this. The person who actually runs the firewall doesn't get to say what's allowed through and what's not. Somebody else decides, and they tell them what to do. So that guy told me, but then the vice president said, no, I want to be able to dial in from home through the firewall and use CoolTalk. Okay, man. You need Cool Talk. I'll enable it. By the way, you should be aware of the Cool Talk Trojan horse that breaks into our whole computer network and took, you know, takes the whole thing over. Doesn't matter. He's a vice president. He wins.
Okay? That's how it works. Who dictates is very critical for the operation of your firewall. Policy impacts testing and audit requirements.
Right? If the policy doesn't say we have an internal audit requirement that all of our information systems of this value level get audited this often, the firewall will never get audited. It'll never get tested. You'll never know whether it actually does anything. In fact, I know of some organizations, I'm going to be at one tomorrow, where the people in charge of security don't know what the firewall rules are. They don't know the rules. They tried to find out. The people who run the firewall won't tell them.
All right, policy impacts things like cost-benefit trade-offs, right?
The policy normally says information is protected to the level appropriate to its values, commensurate with its values. So, hey, we're protecting like $5 worth of information. How much are we going to spend on this firewall? Nothing. We're not spending. We're protecting $400 million. If this one bit gets out, we'll lose $400 million real cash. How much do we spend on a firewall?
Probably greater than zero, right?
Might not be much, but
policy impacts standards and procedures and everything else. And so in fact, what you need to do is first set the policy, and from there, everything else follows.
Okay, fundamental principle.
One that's not applied universally. Technical safeguards. Firewalls are sold as all things to all people.
Right? They're sold as, buy this firewall, you'll be safe. That's what they sell. That's not what you're getting.
They're technical safeguards. They're like every other technical safeguard. They don't control people's behavior.
Okay? They can limit what people can do from a technical standpoint, but they don't control the behavior of the people.
They don't prevent other entry points.
So, like, if I just dial out and make a connection to the internet, that firewall isn't going to prevent anything from coming in over that connection.
They have to be used properly in order to work. Very few people actually know how to use them properly. So we all started to use them improperly, and they don't really work that well. They have to be managed. They have to be configured. They have to be tested. I mean, I've been to firewalls where, you know, the guy that was running the firewall said, it's a real true example from a company I was doing an audit on.
The guy that runs the firewall says, SendMail is not working on this machine. It's configured out. You can't run SendMail on this machine. I said, okay, I believe you. I'm just doing an audit, so my job is to check. So I checked, and it was running SendMail. And I said, seems to be running SendMail. And he said, huh, that's peculiar. No, but it's not running SendMail because it's configured so it doesn't run SendMail. I said, let's test it. We'll go to another machine and we'll try it. And I went over to port 25 and said, yep, it's running SendMail. And he said, no, it's configured not to run SendMail. I said, I believe you. But when I tried it, it worked. So there must be something wrong here. I mean, it turns out that the graphic configuration module just did the wrong thing. And nobody had ever tested it before. This was a revelation. It's not a piece of genius work. It's not a piece of great detective work to try using SendMail and see if it works. But nobody ever did it.
They never tested. So basically, these tools, this technical safeguard, this tool that we have called a firewall, tools like Alter will work best when a skilled craftsperson handles it. So the Polaner is going to make skilled craftspeople. Firewalls are limited in their defensive capabilities.
Okay, they are not all things to all people.
For example, firewalls cannot understand content.
Recently, some firewalls have incorporated software that checks certain types of content to verify, for example, that no known computer virus is there. Okay, that's a good thing.
But they don't understand content. There will always be some kind of content you can pass through the firewall that is potentially harmful to a system behind it if the system behind it is not also well protected, well designed, and properly implemented. So the firewall doesn't protect you from implementations behind the firewall. They are susceptible to subversion.
Every firewall I've ever seen has been subvertible.
In fact, guess what? They don't protect against insiders at all.
In other words, if the firewall was perfect, it would be a 20% solution to security. Okay? Not 100% solution to anything.
In fact, they actually rarely deal with denial of services or corruption of information at all.
They're almost always oriented towards preventing the leakage of secrets.
It's fairly easy to corrupt things through a firewall, somewhat harder to get things to leak. Although, if you can corrupt things behind it, you can usually get things to leak. They're not always transparent or automatic.
Now, people want them to be transparent and automatic, but transparent and automatic means doesn't work as well. Not as effective. Okay? And just to give you an example, there are systems that allow you to order information. And you load the information that you order, and that's the only way information is supposed to be allowed to come in, is you order it. And then you use the information, and that's supposed to be secure. Nothing can get out, nothing could leak, because we're just ordering the information, and you have to order it to get it, so nothing could leak. But if you bring in information that's a program, and it's a Trojan horse, and the Trojan horse goes and places a bunch of orders, the orders can be used to send out information. It's called a covert channel. Okay, I send an order that says, I want one, the code is 5077324. Or I want one, the name of the, you know, the amount of pay of the president of the company is $400,337,014. I want one of those things. Well, there is no such thing, but nevertheless, the order went through, and I got the information leaked out that way.
So there that's how you use corruption to then leak secrets for them. They're not always transparent and automatic. So if they're transparent and automatic, that means that automated attacks like this work. And they run on insecure operating systems.
So you take your firewall, supposedly the best thing since sliced bread, but you run it on Windows. Oops. You run it on Unix. Oops, Unix isn't secure. You run it on, in fact, almost nothing is secure. So if the operating system isn't secure and safe, then the firewall is only going to be as secure as the operating environment that it lives in.
So don't view firewalls as the solution. See, this is that wisdom thing down at the bottom. Don't view firewalls as the solution.
View them as an arrow in your quiver. It's another tool that you're going to use to do a better job, an appropriate job, of protecting information.
Firewalls are not plug-and-play solutions. You do not buy a firewall, plug it in, and say, I'm safe. Of course, you never would say, I'm safe, now that you've started to hear this, and you're going to hear more, and you're going to start crying at some point, probably. But you know, boy, you know, it takes at least a full-time person to run a firewall properly. If it's performing a substantial amount of functions, a lot of information passing through it. Now, I have a tool that'll build you a firewall that will cost nothing to run. It's extremely effective. See, here it is. Carry it with me at all times. It's this pair of scissors. All you need to do is slip that wire, and I can guarantee you there's no information going to be passing through that wire. If I cut that wire, now somebody, unfortunately, is probably going to go and try and reconnect it. And then you're going to run into troubles. But as long as you've implemented my true slice of wires firewall, no information is going to get through. Other than that, you need people to make sure it works right. They're very easy to set up incorrectly.
Now, that means that let's see, some of you have configured firewalls of some sort or another, right? I know at least one of you has configured a firewall. And did you make any configuration errors?
Yep. Okay. Everybody makes mistakes. I set up firewall. I make configuration errors. I try to find them as fast as I can and fix them. But it's really hard to get it right, and it's really, really easy to get it wrong. And it's really easy to get it really, really wrong. Okay? In fact, usually we get it so wrong that it looks like it works. Right? Information seems to pass through it. It works. Excuse me, that's not the purpose. We could have just put a wire there instead and information would still pass through it. We want to do better than that. How much better you do, you're not really sure. They're very hard to maintain properly. Every time you make a change, you have to make sure that change is right. You have to figure out that it's right before you make it. Otherwise, if it's wrong, you're opening up a window of vulnerability. They have to be adapted over time. Hey. Man, the boss wants CoolTalk. I got to change the firewall so CoolTalk will work. What do I do? I don't know anything about CoolTalk. What's the protocol for CoolTalk? Is that a vulnerability? If so, how do I cover the vulnerability? The manufacturer won't tell me what the protocol is. Ouch. I don't have a clue what this thing does, but we're just shoving these bits through here.
And I'm supposed to say it's safe? Well, I don't know.
Let's figure it out. Each service has to be managed. Audit records have to be examined. So these things generate audit trails. A typical system,
multi-user system, can generate something in the order of 1 million audit records per day. Okay, a lightly used one, 10, 20,000 audit records per day. So, anybody here able to read 1 million audit records per day and figure out whether anything bad happened? Probably not. Probably take a crew of 100, and then you still wouldn't know, because after you've looked at a few thousand audit lines, it's all a blur. Was packet number 4,346,243 at this time the proper packet bedtime? How would I know?
Configuration changes have to be tested. So anytime you make a change, you need to do a test. Every organization is different, so the needs of the organization are different, so you can't have a plug and play because what works for your group won't work for my group because you're doing something different from what I'm doing. Every policy is different. Okay, our organization is the same company, except the policy in this room is none of this, and the policy in that room is lots of that. Different policy, we need to do something different. And then it's only one part of this overall protection puzzle. The overall picture of information protection. It has to fit in with the other things we do. So if we're oriented towards technical safeguards, we're going to have a different firewall configuration than if we're oriented towards people behaving properly. It just means the firewall is going to do things differently because we have a different basis for what the firewall is supposed to do.
Firewall is also generally an interface to the outside world. And if you're doing it right, it should be, I guess, the only interface.
If there's another interface, that interface is a way to get past the firewall. It also means that interface represents you. So if your firewall is unfriendly or mean or, you know, does things like blow out, you know, anybody that tries to send them a false packet gets 1 million packets back, 400,000 pieces of email, then it's not going to be perceived as being a very friendly environment for people to use, although maybe that's the perception you want. There may be legal notice requirements for prosecution of people that are breaking the law. So the firewall is a place where you would not, where you would want to provide that legal notice. How do you do that? And basically, if you look at it, you know, if this is your organization, the firewall is this thin outer shell, and your organization is this gooey center.
So if they ever break through that shell, and that's what you've based your protection on, they're going to be able to go around that gooey center without any barriers in their way.
Okay? So in fact, once attackers get past most firewalls, there's little to stop them. And 80% plus of attackers are past the firewall when they start, because they're insiders. It's also an emerging technology, as in new and changing and not mature and experimental, and holes are found every day, and knowledgeable attackers can get past them. Modern integrity protection at best, and very little in the way of denial of service protection, and mild secrecy. They're new, they're evolving, they're changing, they're not old, trusted, we know how it works, we know everything there is to know about it, we know all its limitations. They're like helter-skelter, okay? In other words, whatever you put there, maybe it'll be effective. We can't really guarantee you very much. Here's a social engineering example. This shows you the great value of a firewall. There's a multi-billion dollar company involved, very sophisticated firewalls in place, experts in computer security. An attack took place over a period of less than a week. It gained unlimited internal network access. They got unlimited access to the whole internal network. Accounts on several machines were gained, up to $1 million to be taken at will. I'll move this $1 million. Okay, done. A new expense accounts were created. There was a cryptographic modem provided to the attacker so we could, you know, get through the encryption algorithms that they used to secure their network. Passwords and usage manuals were obtained, and so, and lots of other stuff. Okay. So how did this happen?
The guy made a phone call and said, "Hey man, they didn't say that. They said, "Hi there, I work for your new vice president of marketing. And he's going to be on the road this week, and he hasn't had a chance to stop by the office yet, and I need you to send me the following list of items immediately at this address so that we can give it to the new vice president so he can start working right away." "Oh, yes, sir, I'll rush right out and do it." and they set the cryptographic modem, the access codes, an expense account, all this other stuff. You send it via Federal Express or UPS or what have you, ship it out. Next day, I have unlimited access to your network through the firewall.
Okay. Another, the same people that did this, that brought to you by the same folks, that did this example, is another multi-billion dollar company. And the losses in 1 week of attacks were estimated to be,
you could have taken $1 billion from the company in a week, as the information they had could have been sold on the open market for $1 billion, according to the executives in the company.
Okay? These are not sophisticated attacks. They're not technical attacks.
The firewall won't protect you. They're outsider attacks, but they don't go directly at the firewall. They don't try to break through the front door to get in. They get a key or they ask somebody to open it for them.